Hold on just a second. Let them. All right, Mr. Beard, you're good to go.
May it please the court, counsel, Judge Stewart, members of the panel. Here today to talk about the district court's admission of some text messages in a criminal case, Cynthia Ortega's, for when she was charged on two counts with conspiracy to possess, distribute controlled substance, as well as the substantive count. Now, I'm going to talk about, with your permission, I'm going to talk about what I'm going to call the little issues. They're significant, but intrinsicness, extrinsicness, and harmlessness. But I want to do it against a larger backdrop, because I want to respectfully ask that the panel consider that what made this case, what made the government's case, were a series of text messages, unresponded to, that arrived the day after an individual was taken into arrest, the day after the alleged conspiracy was to have terminated, May 23rd of 2002.
You say it made the case. You don't think there would have been a conviction without the text messages?
I think that the jury should have been allowed to hear the evidence without the text messages and decide if that was the case.
That's not what you said.
I'm sorry?
You said it made the case.
I think that if you turn to page 637 of the record, and you'll find that the trial, the U.S. attorney, the prosecutor said, refer to it as one of the most important parts of evidence. So I would simply offer her characterization of that evidence. I think, in fact, that was what was dispositive, because absent that evidence, Judge Clement, what you basically had was a mere presence case. Now, what I also want to point out to the panel before I jump into it, in terms of record issues, these particular claims were the subject of pretrial litigation. There were motions filed and responsive motions filed. And even at the pretrial conference, and you'll find that at approximately page 316 to 320 of the record, the question about what should be done with these text messages was discussed in chambers. And it was at that point where the prosecutor said, well, I don't see how they're any more intrinsic, this notion of this text message that said, do you have a 20 for sale, could be any more intrinsic to the offenses charged. Now, the offenses charged, of course, were this secreted cocaine that was apparently going from Phoenix, maybe to Oklahoma City, maybe all the way over to North Carolina. And it was the prosecutor's contention that, apparently, that our client, Ms. Ortega, was distributing, even though all of this stuff had been secreted away and was actually quite, what is the word I'm looking for? Well, you couldn't reach it easily. They had to take the truck apart to get it. And, of course, the text messages came from an Arizona number, which I think definitely gives rise to an inference that it was someone calling from that area where they were from. I don't want to spend much more time on this. I don't see...
But just because the area code is a different state doesn't mean that that person's in that state. With cell phones now, everybody I know has a different area code.
That's absolutely true. I carry an area code 806, and yet I live in Dallas, and that's West Texas. You're absolutely correct in that regard. And perhaps it's time to point out that, although maybe prematurely, the government made no attempt whatsoever to find out who this was from or who the person was and what have you, to find out where, in fact, that person might be.
Nobody ever found Mike?
The government didn't choose to investigate, Your Honor. So we don't know who Mike was. And I think that does touch upon what I refer to as the broader issue, and that is, who knows who Mike is? Certainly, if, in fact, that was one of the, quote-unquote, most important pieces of evidence, it lends at least the question in some quarters, where did it come from? Especially consider the timing of the text, and considering the fact that it was never responded to by Ms. Ortega.
Well, they had her phone at that point, right?
Yes, but what I was suggesting was, had this been a text message that had been, had Mike or someone said, hey, do you have this for sale? And then the response came back while she's driving, yes, I do, nor I don't, something like that. I'm sorry?
I thought the text messages were discovered by the authorities after she had already been incarcerated.
Yes, they were. What I'm trying to compare and contrast is that if you have a situation where someone, you have a text inquiry and then you have a response from that individual, it's a far different situation than when you have a text message that comes in after that person's sitting in jail and you don't know where the text message comes from. I'm just talking about a different, for lack of a better term, a different caliber, if you will, or perhaps different inferences to be drawn from the text. I had mentioned the prosecutor's insistence that the texts were intrinsic. And I'd ask the court to take a look at page 316, 317, because there's also something that occurred in chambers that I think is certainly illustrative. And that is, this was a situation where, during the pretrial conference, the trial attorney for Ms. Ortega pointed out that Ms. Ortega had admitted to methamphetamine use during her pretrial services interview. Thus, the government, probation, the court were all aware that she had at least some experience with drug use. And I think that that's important, and now I'm going to leap forward into the extrinsic discussion, because during the trial itself, when the question came up after the judge had allowed the text to come in, the question came up, well, do you know what this 20 for sale refers to? Now, not surprisingly, of course, the government wanted to say, well, the 20 for sale would refer to the type drugs that were found in the car. And I don't think I do Ms. Ortega a disservice by discussing the reason that the government would want that, of course, is because that's going to go to the first Beecham prong to show some type of nexus between the offense charge, the possession of the drugs in the truck, as well as what these text messages were about. But the witness there also pointed out, that the testifying agent also pointed out, that it was possible that, in fact, the 20 for sale did not refer necessarily to those type drugs. So what you have on the record is you have the government aware, defense counsel conceding, the district court aware that the individual had used methamphetamine, had a methamphetamine, was using methamphetamine, and that she, that then, of course, there's a call that this one text that says you have a 20 for sale, and then we have the agent saying it would be contextual as to what exactly the $20 for sale message referred to, what type of drug. You asked me initially, well, does that make the case? I think, in fact, it's very important to understand where the posture of this case was up until the admission of that evidence, Judge Clement, panel members. The briefs point out, and the record will, of course, confirm this, you have a truck going down I-40 heading east. You're stopped, not unremarkably. It happens all the time, actually. Arizona plates, a traffic offense. The DPS officer separates the people and finds an inconsistency in the story. In this particular case, the inconsistency is who picked up whom on the way out. Did Ortega pick up Wassel? Did Wassel pick up Ortega? And I'm not trying to disturb that. That was certainly, I think, legally sufficient to be a subsequent inquiry on the officer's part. And, in fact, that was obviated when he asked for consent and got it. But for purposes of the actual trial itself and the question of legally sufficient evidence to establish guilt, the fact that there are inconsistencies doesn't mean that Ortega's wrong and Wassel's wrong or that either of them are telling the truth. The point I'm simply saying is that for trial purposes, the government's reliance on, oh, well, look at these inconsistent statements. This plus the text, this shows knowledge and intent to distribute. I don't think you get there legally. In fact, I suggest that it's legally insufficient. This was a mere presence case. Pull out the text messages, and what do you have? You have two people in the truck in which a large quantity was found. There were no confessions by either. There were no telephone numbers found. There was no subsequent investigation to show who was going where, anything like this. What Ms. Ortega was described to have been doing was scratching her neck and at one point coloring while the officer's talking with her. But that's all. And so I think that, in fact, the United States attorney was correct when she said below that it, to the jury, when she relied in closing argument, this is the most important, one of the most important pieces of evidence. I think she was absolutely correct. I think it did make the case. So I go back and loop back and repeat my earlier contention.
So I think that addresses your position that it wouldn't be harmless error.
Yes.
To admit the text messages. So now you're about to tell me why it was error to admit the text
messages. I was just going to talk to you about the extrinsic, basically where I think the 404 problem is. And let me preface my remark by pointing out it's not completely clear on what basis the district court ruled. If you look at page 580 of the record, what you're going to find is that the issue had been discussed in pretrial conference. The district court said, okay, I'm going to honor the in limine motion. The government will need to ask about this before you introduce it. The government, in fact, approached, and the judge said, I'm pretty sure I'm quoting, you may proceed. That is to say, proceed with the introduction. But it wasn't clear whether or not the court was saying intrinsic or extrinsic. And then a few pages later, the court says, I find that the probative value outweighs the prejudicial value. And, of course, that may, in fact, add a little bit to the ambiguity because that implicates
for. Well, let's approach it this way. What was the basis for the objection to the admission of the text message? I'm trying to get at what reason not to let him in.
Because it was extrinsic. It was not the.
I don't know what that means.
Well, the.
Was that extrinsic and intrinsic? I think I know the definition of those words.
Yes. Forgive me.
I guess I'm getting a little frustrated. Is there some rule or something in the rules of evidence that would apply that would keep these text messages out?
Yes, I think under 404.
It's the rule on extrinsic and intrinsic evidence.
If the evidence were intrinsic, if it were part of the instant offense, then of course the evidence would be not only
relevant. Which rule is that?
For intrinsic or for extrinsic?
Either one of them.
Well, 401 of course speaks to relevance. 404 is where I'm going right now with the permission.
Your argument is that these text messages are not anchored to the very transaction of drug involvement which the defendant is charged, i.e., there's nothing on the text messages involving her or this transaction, et cetera, et cetera. So if the government argued that it was intrinsic, they would have to be arguing that it's part and parcel of the very transaction that's charged and therefore comes in as relevant evidence, because there's Mike and nobody knows who Mike is and so forth. It's at best just some text messages. So the government has to not ride in on an intrinsic horse, i.e. anchor to the transaction, but it's extrinsic. And if they argue that it's extrinsic, then they've got a higher burden to show some connexity to this situation rather than just throwing in some text message. And then when the government says it's the most important piece of evidence, then it raises the bar. So you're arguing that the trial judge doesn't clearly say why it comes in. If the ruling is that it's intrinsic, it can't be based on the government's theory of the case. And if the ruling is that it's extrinsic, then you're arguing that it's not probative and it shouldn't have come in. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, and because the government, yes, Judge. But let me add also that the theory of prosecution below was that it would go to show intent of distribution. And that's where they were trying to, the government was trying to say
knowledge.
That knowledge slash intent. And so going back, Judge Graves, to I think what you were asking me.
Well, I think I got the answer then.
His answer was, yes,
All right.
Poetry.
But now we have, we've got drug cases. When I say we, I don't mean us, but I mean this isn't the first case where text messages in the drug milieu are put forward, right?
True.
All right. So in the drug milieu in general, we've got text messages. We got lots of stuff that, our cases have kind of said they're, well, in the old days when I started, we'd have said it was part of the res gestae. I'm sure that's a dinosaur term, but it was meant to be. It's kind of that part of that amalgam of this transaction. And so if they've got her sitting here, would have come in, the prosecutor, without a good answer, would say it's part of the res gestae, and the trial judge would say, good, it comes in. You're arguing it can't be part of what I'm calling res gestae, right? That it's peripheral, and without it, all they have is just her in the car.
Yes, and if I were anchoring,
who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, again, the jury, what we're asking is the jury get to pass on those type of questions.
Well, I should ask you the question, and that is, what do you do with the cases that are out there that allow text messages for the purpose of showing knowledge on the part of the defendant, which, let's just say, getting past intrinsic, extrinsic, why wouldn't it be relevant to show knowledge, and it's up to the jury how much weight to ascribe to it.
Well, I think that as a broad response, you would have to look at the text message in question, and this is why I was suggesting this earlier. Look, spatially and temporally, this is something that presumably or inferentially came from far away, came afterwards. There was no subsequent investigation, so while it might be in a given situation that a text message with some of those attributes might in fact be admissible, at least in this case, we suggest that, at least in this case, that they were not. Thank you very much.
All right, I think we've got you. You save some time for rebuttal. I'm sure that the AUSA is going to clear this up, just real clear. Come on up. I don't want to butcher your last name. Kasmerick?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, I've messed it up, or what?
Yes, you said it correctly. Oh. A lot of consonants in there.
Great.
So, may it please the court? Matthew Kasmerick on behalf of the United States. Because the text messages are probative circumstantial evidence of appellant's knowing participation in a drug trafficking conspiracy, the district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting government's exhibits 4, 5, 6, and 7, and the government has supplied copies of those for the bench. Whatever the theory of admission, and there are three approaches here. First, as argued at the district court level, there is an argument that these are inextricably intertwined.
But did you have some burden to at least establish who Mike was or Mike's, you know, somehow involvement in the drug milieu, some at least tangential relationship to drug trafficking, et cetera?
No, Your Honor, I believe we bore an authentication burden because this is much like the unknown caller cases or the stash house cases where officers seize a situs or a person and then there are a series of requests impliedly seeking drugs. So if you think of the stash house case where there's a single owner of a property, if that owner is sitting in handcuffs on the couch and then there are a series of men, maybe named Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who knock on the door seeking a 20.
Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Where was John?
John's not a crackhead, evidently. So I didn't want to poison the well. I used the most holy names I could think of. Matthew, Mark, and Luke knock on the door asking for a 20. That evidence comes in every case as relevant, circumstantial, probative evidence of intent. When that defendant sitting on the couch later denies knowledge of the drugs found. Another good example would be a bookie operation. There are cases from this circuit admitting evidence of subsequent calls. The officer sees the illegal bookkeeping operation and a series of calls placing bets come in. That evidence comes in. The only thing atypical about
the caller is never identified.
And the caller is never identified.
But the phone is retrieved, you know, as part of retrieving all this bookie stuff, right? You have the inference that, you know, the cell phone, the calls are all part of the transactions of the bookie operation, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and to speak to the burden to prove who Mike is, I think, like the unknown caller case, like the bookkeeper case, this evidence is simply circumstantial proof of knowledge. And that's why, in our first argument, we don't run through the 404B analysis, because I simply don't think it applies. It didn't apply in the unknown caller cases cited in the brief. It didn't apply in the 28J cases that we cited, where this evidence just comes in over hearsay objections. It's never been litigated under Rule 404B because it doesn't bear the heavy imprimatur of an other crime, wrong, or act. And to go directly to your question, the government met really the only burden that's required, and that's an authentication burden. And there's no question that the phone was rightfully admitted under that very low standard. The phone was seized incident to arrest.
But you don't want extrinsic, because if you get extrinsic, you got to get in 404B, which then has to relate to not elements of the crime, but relate to other things, not bad acts. There's a whole wad there. What you want is intrinsic, because then you want to argue that it is circumstantial evidence of knowledge related to this crime, and that you're entitled as part of your burden of proof to put that on, and it's up to the jury to describe how much weight to give to it. So you want to be in the intrinsic room frame here as opposed to getting off here on 404B and all that. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that is correct that, at least at the district court level, that was the trial attorney's first instinct to argue that it was intrinsic, mostly based on temporal proximity.
You want us to hold it's not reversible error. I get that, and you really, it doesn't matter to you too much what theory we use, but I'm trying to pin you down between intrinsic and extrinsic, but my sense of your argument, at least, is when you're saying circumstantial evidence, that it was presented as circumstantial evidence to get past this notion that it's a mere presence case.
Yes, Your Honor.
The defense is it's mere presence. She just happened to be there.
Right. And I just very quickly, Your Honor, we're not scared of an extrinsic ruling either.
Okay.
Because this evidence comes in every day of the week under Rule 404B. So I don't have to die on that hill necessarily.
Is the government's position that the mic was looking for crack or meth?
It is the government's position, you know, first, that it's just probative circumstantial evidence of intent. It was the theory at the trial level offered through the testimony, the expert testimony of DEA agent Baldwin, that a 20 is a very specific denominator and quantity of crack cocaine. In fact, he was grilled on cross-examination about whether it could be the methamphetamine that this user had used in the past. And he said, no, that's a tweener, I believe. And he went through a series of slang terms and testified.
It's found with cocaine, which is what you make crack out of.
Right. It's cocaine base. A lot of the case law will refer to it as cocaine base. That's what I understand to be crack. And then there's powder cocaine. And it's important to point out what was found in this case. They're sort of your standard kilo-sized bricks. There were 8 of them, 8 kilograms. In 2 of those, there was a donut-sized hole that were filled with baggies of 20s.
Of crack.
20 ounces of crack in sort of distribution wrapping. So that was the trial AUSA's instinct to argue that that was intrinsic because of the relationship between the word 20, DEA agent Baldwin's testimony about what that slang means.
What's the street value of a 20?
$20. It's about 20. Altogether, there's about 20.2 ounces of these little baggies, and it's a colloquial term. It's sort of a user fix amount, and it's $20. I'm not sure the testimony gets into the precise weighting of it, but it's something that'll fit in your palm. To go to your point, Judge Stewart, the government isn't scared of Rule 404B because under an unbroken line of mere presence, hidden compartment cases, this sort of evidence is always admissible to prove knowledge. And we, of course, start with the Beecham test. We don't even have to clear the first hurdle of the Beecham test because the mere entry of a not guilty plea in a conspiracy case is enough to clear that hurdle. And you just have to look at Broussard. That's at 80 F3rd and 1040. In that opinion, the court says just by raising a not guilty plea in a conspiracy case, we've cleared that hurdle, quote, thus our task is simply to determine whether the requirements of Rule 403 are satisfied. I think they're easily satisfied in this case. Under that second step, specifically that the extrinsic evidence, the probative value thereof, is not substantially outweighed by its undue prejudice. In making that weighting determination, I'd look to the Garcia opinion, 567 F3rd at 728. Quote, 404B evidence is particularly probative where the government has charged conspiracy, because it's often the case that constituent elements of the conspiracy will disclaim knowledge of the entire organization. I think the fact that these phone messages come within 24 hours of the arrest, remember, this is a long-haul trip. We all agree that it begins in Phoenix, but it's either going to end in Oklahoma City or it's going to end in Lumberton, North Carolina, which is what the GPS showed or was programmed for. In that window, Ortega is receiving text messages for the precise quantity that they're carrying in the hidden compartment. It's also important to point out that this evidence was offered essentially in rebuttal because the defendants, through their motions in limine, pretrial conference, opening statements, through cross-examination, and all the way through closing, they challenged knowledge. And this was the sort of evidence that's routinely admitted to prove knowledge. So this was actually offered to rebut an aggressive defense that ran the course of the case from start to finish.
So it wasn't part of your case in chief?
It was part of the case in chief, but we knew from the papers filed that they were going to stand up as they did and argue that, or deny knowledge. We knew that this was a knowledge case. And the Fifth Circuit has held when a defendant raises a mere presence defense in a hidden compartment case, the government has to put on other evidence, other circumstantial evidence. And we thought that this was precisely that, other probative circumstantial evidence of intent.
Did it come in the case in chief?
It did come in the case in chief.
Okay.
It came in through two witnesses, Officer, he's a Texas State Trooper, Officer Dollar, testified to the traffic stop and where it was seized, and then DEA agent Baldwin testified to the slang terms and what the text messages meant. And if we just look at the case law, these classic mere presence cases, deliveries come in. Prior and post deliveries of cocaine come in. Prior and post sales of cocaine come in. Prior and post arrests of cocaine come in. Prior convictions even come in, all to go to this element of knowledge and intent, which was the crux of their defense. I wanted to turn to appellant's heavy emphasis on this one line in the record. I believe it's the government's final closing statements. Quote, one of the most important pieces of evidence in the case were the text messages. This is only after it was raised by the defense in their closing. If you go to the first portion of the closing arguments, the government listed 10 reasons for why, 10 reasons disproving their knowledge defense, their mere presence defense. These people were trusted to carry nearly $300,000 worth of material. You don't do that unwittingly. Number two, Ortega had a recent insurable interest in the truck. She was added to the insurance the day before this truck left. Three, probably most important to this case, the sprayer and sprayed mud that were in plain view is a classic hidden compartment technique used by drug traffickers. Four, the inconsistent stories seem to shift blame. Who picked up who and who would most have knowledge of the hidden material? Five, the trip was economically infeasible for the stated reasons of delivering a worker to Oklahoma City or maybe North Carolina. Six, the toolbox lacked all evidence of the construction electrician tools that they claimed they needed. Seven, Wassel could not identify the job sites, the pay scales, the lodging. He knew nothing of his purported work to be done. Eight, it was loaded with all sorts of long-haul supplies, indicating that they were in for a lengthy trip, maybe to North Carolina. Nine, nobody had any of the construction or electrician credentials. And 10, they spent 10 hours together, but nobody could explain the trip, who picked up who, where they were going, what was the purpose. All of these were raised in the government's opening statements at closing, I should say. And then in response, Ortega raised the issue of text messages. And at this point, the government mentions in one line that she forgot to mention one of the most important pieces of evidence. The weight assigned by appellants at oral argument is mismatched with the actual weight assigned at the trial case. And while we're sort of on this category of harmlessness and what the other evidence was, I would point the court to an unreported case that nicely summarizes the case law to date, Marshall. It lists eight categories that are deemed sufficient to prove guilty knowledge. Seven of those eight categories of other evidence were present in this case. Inconsistent statements. Wassel said they were traveling to Oklahoma City to do electrical work for Enrique Gomez. Ortega said they were traveling to Oklahoma City to deliver the vehicle and that Wassel was a mechanic. Ortega and Wassel continually disagreed about who picked up whom. The second category, implausible explanations. Again, Wassel claimed to do electrical work but wasn't a licensed electrician, had none of the tools, couldn't identify the relevant job sites, wage rates, lodging, or any of their plans to return to Phoenix. Number three, the third category identified by Marshall, nervousness. There's line after line of testimony that Ortega displayed very deep erratic breathing, vigorously scratched her neck, became very red and irritated. Wassel had shaking hands, dry mouth, elevated heart rate. Sounds like oral argument. Hands shaking uncontrollably. And Trooper Dollar importantly noted that these effects became more and more severe, even after he told them that they were only pulled over for a warning. Ortega's anxiety became so pronounced that they had to call an ambulance, actually. The fourth category, failure to make eye contact. We know that Ortega persistently avoided eye contact with the officer, looking to an art project instead to color. Number five, reluctance to answer questions. If you'll recall from the record, when Trooper Dollar is asking the driver if he's carrying weapons, knives, contraband, anything like that, Wassel is very curt, right up to the point when he asks about cocaine. And then Wassel pauses. Trooper Dollar took note of that. In probably the strongest category, category six, obvious alterations to the vehicle. There was directional spraying of mud. It matched a stucco sprayer that was in the bed of the truck. You can see the government's exhibits showing that. It's very out of place. It's very intentional. It's very consistent with a hidden compartment operation. And then the seventh of these eight categories is the lack of surprise. When they drill and find cocaine, nobody is surprised. They go mute at that point. After meeting seven of the eight Marshall factors, the government also had evidence of other telltale signs of drug trafficking. Long-haul supplies, bare keychain, an empty glove box, an oversized air freshener that looked out of place in any car, and, of course, that Ortega's insurance policy had been dated right before the trip, and that they had three cellular phones. So the notion that the government's rebuttal statement at closing made the text messages dispositive is really just silly. If you look at the evidence sufficiency cases summarized in Marshall, one or two of these factors are usually enough to tip the scales. We have seven of eight and the host of other evidence that I already referenced. So I don't think there's any question that any error would easily be rendered harmless. Quickly on Rule 404B, I'd like to point out that while appellant is correct that the district court wasn't entirely clear on the basis of its ruling, it did make a 403 finding. So since that's the only hurdle we must clear under Beecham, there's no ambiguity about the clearance of that hurdle because the district court did the work for us. It entered a finding and held expressly, quote, that the probative effect outweighs any prejudicial effect. And under Broussard, that's the only thing left to do in this case. You can find that at page 580 of Record Volume 1.
All right. I think we have your argument, counsel, unless you are burning with more.
No, Your Honor. If the panel has no further questions, I'd ask that you affirm the district court.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Beard, you have right of rebuttal.
The question that I would return the court's attention to is whether or not Ms. Ortega was entitled to be tried absent the pollutant that were the texts. Now, I appreciate my adversary and my friends referenced unknown caller cases, people sitting on couches while texts are coming in, and, of course, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all being there. But this occurred afterwards, and the potential for mischief here is quite interesting. These text messages, and by the way, we're saying messages, there's actually one that speaks in terms of a $20 sale out of a total of three or four, came afterwards. I'm looking at page 588 and 589 of the record where the DEA case agent who was talking about what these text messages meant is telling the jury, is it possible, the question being, is it possible that some people might buy $20 worth of methamphetamine? Answer, yes. And it says, and you didn't contact Mike, did you, to ask him what he was looking for, that is to say, what type of drug he was looking for? No, I didn't. We have an admitted methamphetamine user, and that was something that was established early on in the case.
There was only one text message asking for a 20. The government exhibit 4 says you got a 20. That's at 8:37 a.m. And then government exhibit 6 says, do you have a 20 for sale? That's at 6:44 p.m.
Forgive me, Judge. I was thinking about the 20 reference. There may be more than one. There were actually a series of text messages, some that came from a boyfriend, and then others that came from whoever Mike is. So I apologize to the court. I would also point out that what we're talking about here is also proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And I mention that because, of course, while the government has said, well, look at all of these other things to try to obviate harm, the question going in, of course, is what was it that took this case out of mere presence as to Ortega? Not as to both of them, but I'm here talking about where Ms. Ortega is in all of this. And so with those rather brief observations, we would ask that the case be remanded for retrial and that the court order that the text messages, certainly not based on the, I'm sorry, based on what we know right now, that they not be admitted into evidence. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Beard. Thank both counsel for the briefing and argument. Case will be